When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking to Dr. Anne Phillips. Dr. Anne Phillips is Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the London School of Economics. She previously directed the LSE Gender Institute. She's a very well-published author. Her books include Engendering Democracy, The Politics of Presence, Which Equalities Matter, Multiculturalism Without Culture, Our Body, Whose Property, and the Politics of the Human. And today is here to talk to us about a great book she published with the Princeton University Press in 2021 called Unconditional Equals. And welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Before we start the interview, can you briefly introduce yourself, tell us about your field of expertise, and more importantly, why you decided to write this book?
Well, I'm a political theorist. I'm probably best known as a feminist political theorist, but my understanding of feminism has always involved thinking about gender inequalities in relation to wider inequalities. So unconditional equals, well, it continues very much in that vein. And I think what particularly sparked Unconditional Equals, which I kind of think of as a kind of almost like a summation of many of my thoughts about equality and inequality over many years. And maybe one always thinks that of one's most recent book. But what I mainly wanted to do in Unconditional Equals was to take on, to challenge what the happy story that we sometimes tell ourselves about the progress of equality. I mean, not the progress of material equality, because I think we're all well aware that we live in a world where material inequalities are, if anything, growing daily and are an enormous problem. But I think there's still a kind of comforting story that we tend to tell ourselves. And when I say we, I'm thinking particularly those in the West who tend to claim equality as a Western value. And we have very much this kind of sense that that we've kind of arrived at a point where we in the West now agree that all individuals are, in some important sense, of fundamentally the same value. This is evidenced by the fact that in democracies we give all adults the equal right to vote. So there's this kind of complacency about where we've got to in the progress of equality. And yet we look around the world, we look around our own immediate environment, and it's so evident that we do not believe that all individuals are of equal value. You know, one thinks of the class inequalities, the racial inequalities, the gender inequalities. In Europe, major problem of Islamophobia, anti-immigrant feeling. All of these things really give a lie to the idea that we live in a world where, you know, we now have reached the shared assumption that we're all of sort of fundamentally equal significance. What I wanted to ask in the book or to explore in the book is this something about the dominant ideas of equality that we currently work with that are contributing to this complacency, that are kind of contributing to this kind of easy taken for granted assumption that somehow we have arrived at this condition of believing people equals against all the evidence? And the argument that in essence I make is that we're operating with a conception of equality that is conditional, and that we need to move to a fully unconditional understanding of equality.
And that's the title of the book, Unconditional Equals. You have a number of, you raise a number of great points in the book. We'll get to them, and also those conditions based on which this complacency is based, that side. But before that, can you talk about your personal experience as well, how you evolved in your understanding of equality. And then you bring up this term, which I guess was used by some, I mean, was invented by some other theorists, I'm not sure, the great leveling. And then you talk about why income gap inequality has actually increased in the US and also across the world since 1970s. So can you tell us a little about your own personal experience, how you reconsider your ideas of equality and or inequality, and then talk about why we've had this widening gap in inequality since 1970s.
Yeah, I won't be able to explain all of that, but I think it's part of what contributed to the complacency that I'm talking about is that the 20th century, for much of the 20th century, particularly in the richer countries of the world, there was a kind of move towards lesser material inequality. There are all kinds of contributors to that. The two world wars were important contributors. I mean, lots of people got very rich during the world wars, particularly armaments producers. But the wars destroy wealth. They eliminated some of the wealth. Also, of course, when countries are fighting wars and they're relying on their population, and in the course of the First World War, actually sending millions of their citizens to die, there's a kind of increasing impetus on governments to actually begin to address the needs and the concerns of the broader mass of their citizens. So there's a number of kind of elements that build into it. People also talk about how in the United States, there was a lessening of population growth, partly lessening immigration through the 20th century, which meant that skilled workers were able to take advantage of this, unionize, and bid for higher wages. So lots of different elements go into it. But basically, much of the first half of the 20th century was a period in which a lot of governments were introducing taxations on the wealthy and on property. They were beginning the formation of what we know as the welfare state. You were getting a reduction in the discrepancy between the highest income and the lowest income, but also, I think, very significantly, a reduction in the differential between unskilled and skilled workers. So the way in which it's related to the complacency is that, I mean, I was born in 1950. I grew up in this period, 50s, 60s, 70s, in which one still had a sense of things were getting better, right? Things were moving. I mean, people very often nowadays say that people of my generation and indeed the generation after me could assume that we would have a better life materially than our parents had had. And that was certainly true for me. But for our own children, the chances are now that our own children may have a lesser good life than we have. In terms of the material possibilities. So the kind of basically, particularly in the Anglo-American countries, so the United States, the United Kingdom, also Australia and New Zealand, the English-speaking countries, the 70s was the kind of the point at which that turned around. You got the rise of what people describe as neoliberalism. The deregulation, the kind of, you know, incomes, kind of, the decline in trade union power, all of this, moving into a situation where the differentials between the poorest section of the community and the richest section hugely, hugely extending themselves. And at this point, we begin to see, and this has been written about, of course, by a lot of economic historians, that what looked like a trend towards lessening the income gap and increasing material equality actually was a blip. It was an unusual moment in which there was that process, and we're now perhaps back to the norm. So that's been, I think, like many of my generation, without realizing it, I was kind of subconsciously influenced by that experience of the great leveling into buying into much more than I should have done this idea that we were on, in a sense, a progressive development towards greater equality. And I have a much more pessimistic view of that now. But my pessimism isn't just about the opening up of the material inequalities, because if you have those enormous material inequalities, they almost always coincide with huge inequalities in terms of whether you do actually think that other people are of fundamentally equal value or worth.
That's a very interesting point you brought up. I'm originally from Iran myself, and I moved to New Zealand about 11 years ago to do my PhD, and I had a conception that, I had this idea that more or less these equalities don't really exist in Western societies. But there were several lectures that I went to, several resources that were introduced in those lectures, and I was really shocked. I was really shocked when I realized that, for example, child poverty a few years ago was an issue in New Zealand. I'm sure it still is, but that's something we rarely hear about. And there is a lot of hype in the media about, with a lot of, I don't know if they are really intellectuals or pseudo-intellectuals, best-selling authors who have university seats as well, who write about the angels of progress. I don't remember the title of the book, and you've never been more equal. But the way they look at the statistics is very, very selective to paint this story of continual progress. And there have been a lot of, let's say, interventions. There have been a lot of institutions to address inequality. But you believe that there isn't any sustained, let's say, effort on the part of us to address these inequalities that are based on hierarchies such as race, gender, birthplace. Is that right?
Well, it's not that there haven't been initiatives. I mean, honestly, in many countries, including my own, Britain, there's been, decades of legislation against discrimination on the grounds of sex, against discrimination on the grounds of race, against discrimination on the grounds of religion. So it's not that there haven't been initiatives, or not just the kind of anti-discrimination initiatives, but also movements towards equal pay for women and men. So it's not that there haven't been initiatives. That what strikes me is how difficult it seems to be to move people to the point in which we really do think of others as our equals, right? This notion that we have that somehow we've arrived at this nirvana where we already inhabit this world where this is the norm is so far from the reality. Now, I don't have an explanation of why it is that there's such a persistence of misogyny or racism or homophobia or all of the kind of ways in which people distance themselves and mark themselves out as superior to others. I don't have a kind of explanation. I'm not a historian. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a psychologist. You probably need those to be explanation. But what I think I can contribute to this, and I hope I have contributed in the book, is a critical argument about the particular ways in which we're using the notion of equality, which is contributing to this, which is making this kind of persistence of ideas of superiority and inferiority a continual part of the ways in which we think.
And you're also critical of the idea of meritocracy. It sounds all great, meritocracy, yeah. It's equality based on merit. But why do you think, and how has it damaged the idea of equality?
Yeah. It's worth bearing in mind that the very term meritocracy, which was coined by English writer Michael Young in a book in 1958 called The Rise of Meritocracy, it was coined as a critique, as a satire. And it was a satire of what happens to a society when it comes to measure people, in his argument, purely by their success in a narrow set of exams and qualifications. And two parts of his argument, which I think still ring true. One is that this kind of moves towards a rather single scale of merit, which simply doesn't recognize the kind of huge range of qualities and capacities that people have within our society. So, for example, as feminists endlessly point out, we do not value the capacities that involve caring for others. You know, that this hugely important human capacity to provide efficient but also sensitive care to those who are sick, to those who are dying, to those who are young. We don't value that. Meritocracy narrows the range of things that we value, first of all. But secondly, it celebrates a kind of society in which we compete, maybe through qualifications, through education, for the good positions within society, in a way that encourages us to forget about the probably half society that doesn't succeed in this competition, but also encourages those who have succeeded to really think that they are better people, not just that they are better at teaching, better surgeons, or, you know, better at whatever, you know, particular position they have qualified themselves for. But the meritocracy, the whole language in meritocracy, encourages us to think that those who have succeeded in the competition for the best positions are indeed better people. So I think my argument is not that we shouldn't want well-qualified people for the jobs that they do. I mean, we want surgeons to be highly skilled. We want those who teach to be good at teaching. We want those who care to be good at caring. All of these things, this is not what I think is the problem. The problem is when we think of a society as a meritocracy, we are buying in to this idea of a relatively narrow scale of important qualities, typically tested by educational achievement. And we're also encouraging the view that all that matters is those who actually succeed through the competition, the meritorious, who are then regarded as genuine meritorious. Sorry, it's just that they are genuinely not just good at their jobs, but superior beings. So I'm with Michael Young in this critique in 1958, that this is a term intended satirically. And it's really extraordinary how it's been seized as a positive description of the kind of world that we would like to live in, which is not, in my view, the world of equality that I would like to see us moving towards.
And our modern understanding of equality, again, is, in the book you argue, is sort of bound up with ideas of violence, colonialism, slavery, that part of history of Europe. How is this idea of equality bound up with those ideas?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, historically, there's very much a sense that when we talk about equality today, that we're talking, there have been ways in which people have talked about equality, you know, through the millennia, right? Lots of different versions of equality. But there's a notion that there's a modern idea of equality, which is born broadly in the West, in Europe, in the round about 17th century, lots of kind of people talking about in the state of nature, we are all equals. We are born, in the American Declaration of Independence, we take it as a self-evident truth that, all men are born equal. And that's seen as the kind of the characteristic of the kind of the modern idea of equality. And then through the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century, there's, as I say, this sense that people are talking more and more about equality, demanding more and more from equality. This is exactly the time in which you have the Spanish conquest of the Americas and the Caribbean, the development of the Atlantic slave trade, the growth of the huge British Empire through the 19th century in India, in Africa. But so all the violence of the slave trade and colonialism absolutely coincides with this moment in which there's hugely increased talk about the equality of human beings. And you think, well, what's going on here? What's going on here? Is this just an oversight that people didn't make a connection between the equality that they were talking about and the gross denial of people's equality, in which you buy and sell people as if they are things? Well, obviously, some people did point it out, and there was a lot of critique from anti-slavery and later anti-colonial activists. But is it just that they didn't notice? Or is there some way, that was my question, is there some way in which they're not just historically coincidental, but the growth of ideas of equality and this the violence and brutality of slavery and colonialism? And I think, well, my argument is that to the extent that there is more than just a historical coincidence, it's because of the importance of the ways in which notions of nature have entered into modern ideas of equality. So the focus is very much, it's not on anymore on the idea that we're equal in the sight of God, or that kind of God regards us as equals. It's very much, there's something about our nature as human beings that makes us equals. And of course, that's a wonderfully liberating notion and a potentially very egalitarian notion. But once you start talking about nature, you also focus in on natural differences. And this is the period in which you get the beginnings of kind of very strict racial classifications, racial taxonomies. It's the period in which people talk about the essential differences between men and women. I mean, this is something that grows up and gets stronger through the 19th, 18th, and 19th century rather than decreasing. So there's something about the kind of the use of nature, what we share in nature as the justification for equality, that provides an alibi for a focus on the natural differences that then justify the exclusion of full categories of people from this world of equals. So I think historically it's evident that they coincide, but I think in terms of the kind of the nature of the particular notion of equality we're put to use, there's also a reason that it's not accidental that the violence and the brutality and the exclusion of people coincides with this increasing focus on the equality of all humans.
In your introduction, you also make a reference to scientific research, that genetic scientific research or some biological scientific research that kind of perpetuate the idea that inequality is a natural condition. And sometimes they even make the case that human intelligence or intelligence, however they measure it, is proportionate to where you come from, to people of different races. And I've known several people who do that kind of research, and they're really well-intentioned people, but they just stick to what they call scientific research. And I've talked to them, and they do agree that their results are based on generalization, that they sometimes tend to ignore, let's say, exceptions. And there are lots of exceptions to these scientific rules. But, and like I said, despite the fact that they're well-intentioned, but this is actually perpetuating that idea of inequality, or even justifying or ignoring these structural injustices that generate these inequalities. So what do you think of this new trend of scientific research that claims to have natural origin to inequality?
I mean, it's a trend that is, of course, countered by all kinds of other scientific research, which challenges it. And so, you know, there's a huge amount published on both sides, and I find it deeply infuriating that we still have to have these arguments. So it's, I mean, it seems to me that there's it's not that one doesn't have to deny that there are natural differences. I mean, it would be very odd if we were all born into the world with exactly the same range of capacities, potentialities, and so on. One of my sons is an artist. He's a freelance photographer. The kind of things he does, I have to minimal artistic talent. Another of my sons, well, the other of my sons, I don't have many of them. My other son is someone who goes through life unruffled, untroubled by whatever disasters befall him. I can well believe that these are just characteristics that were in some sense natural, though of course, to what extent they were developed, increased, reduced by the circumstances of their lives, who knows? So not a problem to say that there are natural differences, but first of all, why do we think of natural differences as natural inequalities? I mean, it goes a bit back to what I was saying about meritocracy, that it's kind of the ways in which we tend towards a very narrow selection of the many qualities, potentialities, capacities that people have, selecting out some of those that we regard as the kind of the ones that demonstrate superiority, without recognizing the kind of the huge range of human capabilities and human possibilities. So that's one thing, that the way in which people kind of move so fast from the idea that there might be natural differences to the notion that these are then inequalities, as opposed to we make them inequalities. But secondly, yes, the literature in relation to gender, half the human race are women and the other half are men. I mean, it's such a generalization. Race, I think, and I think many people argue this, is a kind of very much an invented category, which kind of imposes on what we can, you know, we can sort of identify as differences in physiognomy or in skin color, and then imposes on that assumptions about intelligence, about personality, about attitudes to life in ways that came into being, again, round about a time at which you've got the development of the development of the empires of the last 400 or 500 years. I think the scientists continue to debate. What I would say is establishing natural differences does not mean natural inequality, but also the attempt to kind of produce generalizations on the scale of either gender or some sort of constructed notion of what race is. I mean, I have very little confidence in any of that research. Though I do read some of it, and I do read some of the counter research that is produced, and you know, good luck to the people who are carrying on debunking the science and
And as you mentioned, it's kind of sad that we're still having those arguments. You still need a lot of scientists to come.
Women green.
Let's talk about a non-foundational account of equality. That was a new concept to me. What do you mean by a non-foundational account of equality?
So this is very much a kind of a term that comes up within the political theory, political philosophy literature. So there's a kind of sense that it's part of people thinking of a kind of post-religion or post-metaphysics way of thinking about equality. So you can't sort of justify the equality of all humans by reference to something that God tells us, right? Or you can't justify it by reference to a kind of notion, you know, as in some versions of Christianity, that, you know, humans have souls and that's what makes us equal. What people have tried to do in the kind of the more secular ways of thinking about equality is to say things like, well, human beings, think about the kind of ways in which human rights are talked about. People talk about all humans have this shared dignity, right? It's because of our shared dignity as human beings that we all have these human rights. Or people say it's because human beings, unlike non-human animals, have rationality. And because of that rationality, they all should be regarded as, in some important sense, equals. These are searching for a foundation or a justification for treating people as equals. And I think once you start searching for this kind of thing, this characteristic of human beings that justifies treating them as equals, you're setting a test. You're saying, this is why, it's because of this quality X that you have that I'm going to regard you as my equal. And if evidence emerged, perhaps because of the scientific researchers, that you didn't have this quality X, then I'm terribly sorry, but I can't any longer regard you as an equal. The point being that, you know, almost whatever you offer is your justification. It's kind of, it's creating a condition which not everyone may meet. And historically, as we know, not everyone did meet. Women were excluded because they weren't deemed to have sufficient rationality. Africans were excluded because they were deemed as closer to animals in their nature than to human beings. They were seen as having this characteristic of animality. So that the characteristics become a basis for exclusion. So what I think we need to look for, and it's there in a lot of the, it's not as though it's something nobody's ever done. It's there in a lot of the politics of diet equality and a lot of the movements and a lot of the language. It's a way of thinking about equality that just cuts free of these kinds of attempts to give a grounds, a justification. I don't mean not giving reasons. I mean, if you want to kind of talk to people about, well, why should you regard others as equals? Of course, you'll give all kinds of reasons about why you should. But the reason should not be based on there is something about these human beings, some grounds, which is the justification. Because as soon as you move down that line of argument, you create far too much space for identifying some humans as not qualifying, not fitting those kinds of grounds. I mean, actually, one of the ways, I mean, it's worth saying, one of the ways in which this figures in contemporary discourse is it's almost as though we've moved from the idea of who is or isn't a human being, right, to the idea of who is or isn't a good human being. And I'm thinking of things like the ways in which in both America and my own country that prisoners are denied the right to vote. And in America, as we know, in some states, you know, prisoners, even after they've served their sentence and they've released from prison, can be denied the right to vote for the rest of their lives. It seems to me what's going on there is that people are saying, you have to be more than human to qualify to be treated as an equal in our society. You have to be a good human, right? And if you become a bad human, we'll not only lock you up, you know, the idea of punishing people for crimes that they've committed, that's kind of fair enough. But that we will no longer treat you as we'll no longer allow you one of the most fundamental expressions of our seeming equality, which is the right to vote. So it's as though you now disqualify yourself because you don't fit the image of a good human. All of these things are like setting up conditions which you have to kind of meet, tests that you have to pass in order to qualify for equality. Should not be something we qualify for. It should be something that, you know, we just commit ourselves to, that we, you know, we commit ourselves to the principle that all humans are equals.
And as you rightly mentioned, so defining humanity, or sorry, equality based on some shared human conditions could prepare the ground for some exclusions, as you mentioned by the example. The other extreme, so the extreme of that could also be the rise of nationalism or ethnocentrism as well. Am I right to assume that?
Yes. I mean, that's, in a way, that's a kind of, I mean, the way people will talk about that is that they'll talk about it as, nationalism is defining people's rights or access to equality on the basis of whether they belong or not to the nation, right? So it's like setting aside the question of whether you're a human being. It's whether or not you're a kind of, it's a very narrow condition that's being set there. It's not just are you a human being, but are you a member of the nation? And then, as we know, the nation is very often defined in ethnic terms, cultural terms, in religious terms, which then exclude large numbers of people who had thought of themselves as members of the nation, but turn out not to be accepted as such. So nationalism, yes, is very much setting conditions, and often very tight exclusionary conditions, on who does or doesn't count as a member of the nation. That, I think, is absolutely clear and obvious. I think it's a kind of a slightly more challenging argument to say that people are also doing that when they talk about the equality of humans. But it seems to me it's the same kind of process, that you're defining those who count as equals, or who are entitled to the rights and the possibilities that we offer people, by reference to whether they have this particular characteristic. And increasingly in nationalist movements in the 20th and 21st century, the characteristic has included a particular notion of ethnic identity, rather than just whether you're a citizen, whether you have, you know, citizenship rights within concrete. And that plays out in extraordinarily powerful anti-immigration movements in contemporary Europe, which are very considerable worry. Which is not to say, I mean, you know, you can make an argument for the immigration control, you know, but the anti-immigration sentiment is much more of the form of immigrants are like, they're totally different beings from the citizens of the country. Mm. You know, it's not as though, and there is that kind of exclusion of them from even the category that is so deeply troubling.
What do you mean when you talk about equality as a political commitment?
Yeah, I mean so that relates to the kind of the critique that I'm making of foundational accounts of equality, because I mean there's a lot of work in contemporary political philosophy which is trying to work out, well, you know, okay, so we say that we're all in some sense basic equals. What is the basis for this? What is the justification for this? What are the grounds for this? What is it about us that makes us equals, and so on? So there's all this philosophical search for the grounds. And, you know, and as I've said, I think that kind of search always meets with exclusionary possibilities. And I think one should move from that to something which is much more just acknowledging that equality is, it's not the conclusion of either a philosophical argument or an empirical investigation into, you know, what kind of human being you are, whether you're the same kind of human being as I am. It's not the result of philosophical inquiry or scientific investigation. It's a political commitment, and it's something that has become this is where I do think this progress has become increasingly powerful as a demand and a claim over the centuries, that people insist on their equality, they claim their equality, they commit themselves to equality. But we need to recognize that it is a political commitment, rather than saying, it's not something you can prove. You can't prove that we're equals. You can't prove that either by scientific research or by philosophy. But you can make a commitment to this. And I think that's what political movements calling for equality do. They commit themselves to equality as a sort of central value that they are pursuing. And I think that's a much more healthy way to understand what we're doing when we talk about equality, than to think of it as something that we're trying to establish, we're trying to justify, we're trying to prove, in which case we do get rather vulnerable to some of the scientific research that you've been talking about, you know, because if you put it into the realm of proof, and then somebody comes along and says, but we've discovered that, you know, this group doesn't have characteristic X, but that group does. You're very vulnerable to that, but you shouldn't be vulnerable to that, because equality is a political commitment.
And to bring about that political commitment, do we need any socioeconomic conditions to enable that commitment to equality?
Yeah, absolutely. And that I suppose, goes back to some of what I was saying at the beginning about the huge increase in inequalities. I mean, it's a strange time because you could say worldwide, over the last century, there's been a reduction in inequalities between countries. I mean, one thinks of China, for example, and the kind of the transformation of the lives of poor Chinese over the last century. That's just one of many examples. So it's a time worldwide of reducing inequalities between countries, but in most cases, hugely increasing inequalities within countries. And I think that kind of material inequality makes it incredibly difficult for people to think of one another as equals. I mean, you asked me earlier about what it is that kind of, in a way, stops people from seeing others as equals. And I do think that kind of the scale of material inequalities is one part of that. You know, it's not just that we have a particular conception of equality that I think is the wrong conception. If you live in a world where the level of material inequalities is such that we live more or less separate from one another, that we can live sort of almost segregated lives in which the rich have no idea about the kind of the lives of the poor. They see them as kind of just alien beings, just actually a source of both contempt and fear. The kind of the poor have equally no knowledge other than possibly some a wish that they could share some of the resources of the rich. It's not a world that generates that sustains the capacity to really think of one another as people like oneself, right? So I do think that one of the ways in which we move further and further away from the possibility of really thinking of one another as equals is that we live in a world where the scale of the material inequalities actually makes us live in separate worlds. That's one thing that I'd say. I mean, the other thing is just that, you know, all of the achievements that we've made in terms of political equality or legal equality or civil equality are continually undermined by the material inequalities. So, the right to vote, obviously, we know that doesn't deliver anything like an equality of influence in politics because, you know, the people there, you know, those who have wealth, contacts, influence, are able to have much more influence on public policy than those who simply cast their vote in the ballot box every 4 or 5 years. We also, things like equality before the law, we all have the equal right to take our case to the law courts, but if you can afford the most skilled barrister in town to represent you, your chances of winning your case are, of course, immeasurably better than if you either have to just represent yourself or you have to deal with the services of an incredibly overworked legal aid lawyer who barely has time to read your case before going and representing you. So material inequalities, in some ways, make a mockery even of the political and legal equalities that we've achieved. But I think they also hugely eat into our capacity to think of one another as beings like ourselves.
There is another question I'm really interested to know more about, and I've been interviewing different people, and when the timing is right, when the topic is right, I usually pose this question, and that's about identity politics. So there are two groups of people who dismiss identity politics. One of them is, of course, right-wingers or conservatives who completely deny any kind of the existence of any inequality and justice. So that's a different case. We don't want to talk about it. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people, liberals or those on the left, who dismiss class politics, identity politics, sorry, because they, not that they're against, racial or gender inequality, but they say that to bring about equality, we need to focus on economic means. And they are sometimes labeled class reductionists. So do you believe that equality is only achieved through these economic avenues, and should we dismiss identity politics and focus on the economic aspects to bring about that political commitment that you've been talking about?
So I very much resist, and I have, I think, throughout my writing, throughout my career, resisted the idea that there's identity politics on the one side and there's questions of material inequality or class politics on the other side. So I come at this, you know, through my feminism and feminists from very early on were rejecting the idea that somehow through mobilizing around issues to do with gender, that we were undercutting the more important class politics of our non-feminist socialist comrades, that kind of opposition has kind of stymied so much politics over so many decades, and indeed is still very much creating problems. It's also, I think, it's kind of part and parcel of what I've been trying to say about the kind of the current ways of kind of thinking about equality at the moment, and this complacency that I started with, the complacency about we already live in a world where it's taken for granted that we're all in some important sense equal. I think those who want to reject identity politics, a lot of them actually buy into that complacency. They think, you know, what are women going on about? You know, we already live in a world in which men and women are finally, they're recognized as equals. We realize they had a hard time for many centuries and that they were denied the vote and they were denied the right to own property and denied this and the other. But we're way beyond that. Men and women are kind of regarded as equals now. So all this talk about identity politics is just distracting us from what is the much more important question, which is the material inequalities. And it's kind of part of that extraordinary, that assumption that we've already arrived, that we've solved the identity problems, that, right, we don't any longer differentiate on the basis of gender. We don't differentiate on the basis of race. We don't treat people differently. The only problem that remains to us is that we have material inequalities. Seems to be so far from the reality that the identity, the so-called identity issues, I don't like the language of identity politics very much, but the reality of it, which is to say that it's the ways in which, whether or not we are regarded as inferiors, that there are ways in which people are regarded as and treated as inferiors, which have often coincide with them being materially disadvantaged, but they're not entirely identical to that. And that's something that we need to continue to take account of. So I'm, I think some, you know, you could always come up with some aspects of identity politics which do seem to have, in a way, lost contact with the material realities of the world sometimes. But fundamentally, these are all part of the inequalities that we are facing, and you cannot, realistically claim that, we've sorted out all the things that people obsessed with identity politics are worried about, and can therefore happily just concentrate on the material. That dichotomy, to my mind, just doesn't work, and it's something that in many of my writings I have tried to challenge. So no, I wouldn't dismiss identity politics.
No, actually, one of your colleagues from Columbia University was talking to about a year ago. I posed the same question, Bernard Harcourt. So I posed the same question, and he more or less gave me the same answer as you did. I'm interested also to know more about a relational account of equality that you talk about in the book. What is a relational account of equality?
I mean, this again is a reference particularly to debates within the political theory, political philosophy. So there was a huge amount of the work on equality among political philosophers for many years through the 80s, 90s, what have you, was focused on, okay, we want equality, but equality of what? What exactly are we trying to equalize? Are we trying to equalize resources so that everyone has, you know, exactly the same parcel of resources? Are we trying to equalize opportunities so everyone has starts with the same, everyone starts in the same starting place? Are we trying to equalize people's welfare so that those who have greater needs, perhaps because of disability, actually are entitled to more resources? Huge amount, endless debates about exactly, you know, what do we mean by equality? How do we distribute things to ensure that we get equality? And this has been very profoundly criticized by a number of theorists, including Elizabeth Anderson, Samuel Schechter, Jonathan Wolf, who tend to be described now as relational egalitarians, who kind of pull us back to a huge amount of what people care about when they care about equality is whether or, is whether people relate to them as equals. And that if you just focus on these kind of questions about exactly what things are we distributing and in what kinds of proportions, you're actually losing sight of the real thing that people get. People feel that they're challenging when they're challenging inequality. They're challenging hierarchy. They're challenging domination. They're challenging oppression. They're not just challenging an unequal distribution of resources, though that's clearly part of it. They're actually challenging that people are treating them as inferiors. And maybe they're treating them as inferiors because they have lesser resources, which is goes back to the point about you can't separate these two out as if they're separate matters. But that, you know, it's how people relate to one another and what it means to relate as equals that is crucial. I mean, I'm a bit critical of some of the so-called relational egalitarians because I think... I think in that case, some of them do move a bit far away from thinking about the challenge of material inequalities and move in the direction of saying, as long as we all have enough to be regarded as full citizens, then that's all we need. And I think huge material inequalities matter much more than that. But generally, the idea is that instead of just thinking of equality as a kind of matter of distributing things more fairly, think about what is a society in which people actually relate to one another as equals. What would we need to maintain, create and maintain?
And as a final question, which one do you think is more important, to define equality and justice or to identify different forms of injustice or inequality?
I'm glad you asked that because very often when people talk to me about the book, I consider it an important part of the argument. Mm. People very often don't focus on that part of the argument. I think the, perhaps just to go back a step, and it relates to some of the debates within feminism. I have had through my life rather a kind of a clear idea of what I think equality between the sexes involves. And for me, it basically would involve there no longer being any presumption that because you're a man, you do certain sorts of things, because I'm a woman, I do other sorts of things. So there'd no longer be any presumption that women typically do the caring work and men typically become engineers or whatever it might be. That in that sense, men and women would in a sense, they'd become interchangeable, that there would be no gender hierarchy, there'd be no gender division of labor. And that's been my image of what equality between the sexes involves. But I'm very well aware that there are feminist movements throughout the world that are totally committed to what they see as gender equality and the rights of women. But they don't think that having some kind of gender division of labor is such a problem, right? They think that you can have men assuming responsibility for particular kinds of activities, women being more responsible perhaps for some of the activities within the home. As long as women are recognized as equals and have equal kind of political authority and control over their incomes, then the fact that there's a typical woman's job and a typical man's job is not a problem. And I've come over the years to see my notion of gender equality is just a bit too defined and fixed. I mean, I haven't particularly changed my own view, but I think the crucial thing is not to convince everyone that this is what gender equality means, but to actually tackle the areas where there is gender inequality, gender oppression, gender domination, where it's much easier for us all to agree on what are instances of those than for us to agree on what should be the end state. And I think that argument, which for me evolved out of thinking about issues to do with feminist debates, is a more general argument that the crucial thing is not to get caught up in endless debates about exactly what does it mean to treat people as equals, but to start from, this is clearly a case of inequality. This is clearly a case in which some people are asserting their superiority over others. Let's see what we can do about that. So, so I'm glad you asked about that, because that I see as quite an important part of my argument.
And as a last question, I always ask this, is there any other project you are currently working on? Because some of the books that you previously published were also had to deal with the idea of multiculturalism, equality. So I can see this thread. Is there another project you're working on or thinking about writing a book anytime soon?
It's been slightly a problem for me that, as I said at the beginning, I kind of see this book as in some ways a culmination of many of the things I've been thinking about. So it's brought me temporarily, I hope, to a bit of a standstill. And I'm not actually sure exactly what I want to move on to next. So there are various sort of smallish projects that I'm working on or engaged with, but I don't yet have a big new kind of compelling project. But I'm sure that when I do, it will again be to do with inequality and equality.
Professor Anne Phillips, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us on New Books Network and sharing your thoughts about this wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview.